Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, no guest. I want to set time aside to have you be able to call in and share your concepts and points of view on some of our important topics of the day. I'll be giving you more information on why you should be concerned about the quality of the food you eat if it is genetically engineered. Many reasons why we shouldn't have it. And if we have to have it, label it. Also, a commentary today from Timothy Gatto from Counter Currents, I don't want to conquer the world. Interesting concept that he's sharing, and I'll share it with you. We have several other important areas to discuss, including the gulf between two Presidential Peace Prize winners by Cesar Chalela from Common Dreams. Let us begin, always with the latest on health and healing information. How much would our health benefit from leaving the car at home? Now, this was interesting. This is from the Barcelona Public Health Agency, much like our FDA, and I'll quote it. It says, a new study confirms that doing short journeys on foot rather than taking the car or motorbike would avoid the death of 108 men and women just in one city alone each year. And this would imply annual savings of more than $300 million. Researchers from the World Health Organization, along with this group, have estimated that the yearly economic benefits from a reduction in death rates by substituting at least one short vehicle journey with a walk. Well, what if we did it more often? What if we biked in high gear? And then what if we just decided to walk up the steps instead of take the elevator? And what if we walked within the distance of where we need things? Like in New York City, on the Upper West Side, where my office is at 83rd and Broadway, I love walking. Well, I walk up to the store, but then I walk to Lincoln Center, just enjoying the ambient environment, walking down Broadway, picking up on the positive and exciting energy of all the people, going through Central Park, just to walk. So for those of us who live around a park or a place where we feel comfortable or safe walking, do it as often as you can. This study shows you could be saving yourself a heart attack and a stroke, obesity, and metabolic syndrome disorders. Talking about walking, here's an article published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry from the American Society of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, and it's saying this, quote, based on the research in this study, exercise should be given top priority to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Now, we know that the most common cause of dementia, Alzheimer's disease, results in the loss of cognitive faculty. In the majority of cases, Alzheimer's disease occurs after the age of 65, and diet is crucial, exercise is absolutely crucial, and staying away from high-fat, high-protein diets are crucial. And then they did an actual study here, and they found that diet control, exercise, were all pluses in preventing Alzheimer's, because that reduces the incidence of B amyloid plaque forming in the brain. Now, three things that they didn't know, but we do because we've actually had the only, at least that I'm aware of, if there's anything else I didn't see it in the scientific literature, and I didn't hear about it at any of the anti-aging conferences I attend on a regular basis. When you take anything, it's pro-inflammatory. Anything at all. It could be a soft drink or a cup of coffee. It could be some artificial sweetener or eating in a Chinese restaurant, oblivious to that you're getting MSG in almost everything. If you're a vegan and eating a lot of the texturized soy protein, understand that that texturized soy protein could mean it has MSG. We don't read labels very well, and we don't always understand what is in an ingredient when we do. However, all pro-inflammatory foods and beverages, including fluoride in our water, create inflammation throughout the entire body. Now, because your blood circulates a little more or less, depending upon your size, your arteries, whether they're clogged or not, about every 6.5 minutes, it'll loop through the body. And it has to, because it has to carry oxygen. That's how oxygen gets to your cells in the blood. That's how nutrients get to your cells in the blood. And that's how toxins from the blood get into the blood and out of the system, and also through the lymphatic system, which is actually your secondary circulatory system. Now, the idea that you could take in a toxin, let's say you eat a hamburger and you get heterocyclic amines when it's cooked, or barbecued chicken, grilled fish, all of those, once the protein in the actual animal flesh is cooked, it changes the chemistry. And when you change the chemistry of a piece of protein, your body cannot easily break it down the way it should and eliminate the toxins. As a result, those heterocyclic amines are in your system. They're going to go clear through your blood, meaning almost your entire body is exposed to the same identical toxins constantly. But science, and especially medical science, has been so monotheistic in its looking at the body and its specialization, it'll only look at what inflames the kidneys, or a neurologist only what inflames the central nervous system or the brain. Well, it's all the same. There's no such thing as having a toxin go into the bloodstream and only get to a particular organ or gland or tissue. That's not physically possible, because once it's in the blood, well, it would be like you taking some cyanide and pouring it into a pint of water, a gallon of water, a bathtub of water, a swimming tub of water, or a lake of water. If you just happen to be swimming in a lake and someone's dropped a single drop of a toxin in there, there's a high probability that you won't feel any effects. In a cup of water, you'll die. So the blood dilutes toxins, but they're still toxic, and they're still going to hit all of our cells. So when I'm working with a person with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, and you've seen these people, you've heard them on the radio, they've been on a dozen times, their videos, non-scripted and non-edited, are up on the website. You can go there and look under that, I don't know what it's called now, my editor put it up on some, I think Miracles Can Nap, it's something like that. I have over 1,600, let me repeat that number, 1,600 people who have improved or reversed conditions that their medical doctors were unable to do. They're up there. All right? It's not like there's one person. But they all followed the same identical protocol for 80% of what they did. Detox for anywhere from 6 months to a year, year and a half. Eliminate all pro-inflammatory agents from the diet and the water and the air where possible. And then to rebuild the DNA, chelate out, grab those metals and toxins and bring them out. And then you actually break down the amyloid, B-amyloid plaque in the brain, allowing proper circulation, allowing proper oxygenation, and then allowing proper nutrient absorption and utilization in the brain. Then you suddenly see a person gradually, not all at once, not overnight, getting better. It's a slow process because it took a lifetime to create toxic reactions. You can't reasonably expect them to go away in a week. So a year and a half later, you reverse Alzheimer's by 90%. No one's ever done that, that I'm aware of, ever in the world. If they have, bring them forward, because, man, they will be heralded. Oh, I forgot. Bring them forward if it's a drug that did it, if it's a major teaching institution that did it, if it's a government-funded National Institutes of Anti-Aging or Aging, if someone under their grant did it, instant Nobel Prize, gazillion dollars, royalties. But if anyone in the alternative health field does it, doctor, nurse, chiropractor, naturopath, no. It won't count. But hold on, you're talking about a real person having real changes. Someone who can verify it, has her medical records before, during, and after. Doesn't matter. If that were the case, if that were the standard, gold standard by which you judge efficacy and safety, then right now orthodox medicine would have been relegated to nothing except emergency medicine. All of its other duties and chores of preventing or reversing disease would be turned over two different specializations, including naturopathy, etc. But take a look for yourself And you'll see, they're saying exercise. We're saying, good for you. You've got one piece of a 1,000-piece puzzle. Now, why don't you look at their other pieces that are already in place? They won't do that, but at least you know this well in advance of what's going on out there. So when they finally one day do come and go, wow, just discovered the first ever, you'll say, no, sorry, we knew that 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Now, you heard a long time ago about broccoli sprouts. In fact, I did my first program, according to our archivist, 28 years ago on broccoli sprouts. Here's the latest from Green Med Info. Good group, by the way. And this is from a Dr. Veronique Desnaris. It says this, broccoli sprouts and their effect on breast cancer. I'll quote this. Cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cabbage contain many phytochemicals and vitamins and minerals. In fact, in the late 1990s, published studies indicated that there was a link between the consumption of cruciferous vegetables and a lower risk of breast cancer. More recently, the nutrients in broccoli sprouts and their protective effects against the multiple types of cancer have been renewed interest within the research community. One of the key components of broccoli sprouts is a compound called sulforaphane. Broccoli sprouts that are specifically 6 days old contain 100 times more sulforaphane than the mature plant, like a head of broccoli. Last year, about 9 months ago, the Oncology Report found that sulforaphane suppressed breast cancer cell proliferation and growth. I repeat that. This is very important for all the women and men who care about the women in your life. Sulforaphane suppressed breast cancer cell proliferation and growth. In fact, the research committee found that sulforaphane inhibited the growth of cultured human breast cancer cells, leading to the cell death or apoptosis. Now, another promising study from the University of Buffalo found that sulforaphane inhibited the growth of human breast cancer cells and, quote, indicated a potential use of this compound as a chemotherapeutic agent in cancer treatment. Well, that didn't go anywhere, did it? But they still discovered it, and you find this all the time. You'll find all kinds of natural cures, treatments, improvements, not brought into orthodox medicine, even though these were all determined by careful scientific peer review and multiple replications. In fact, could you just imagine the medical mainstream hooking up a sulforaphane drip instead of the chemical concoctions that they give you now? Not going to happen. So why is sulforaphane so powerful in protecting? First of all, it acts as a signaling molecule. Once inside the cell, sulforaphane switches on over 200 specific genes that may be asleep due to toxicity or poor health or trauma or aging. Now, once these genes are turned back on, they produce special detoxification enzymes and antioxidant enzymes. And one of the antioxidants that it helps produce is glutathione. Now, we all know that glutathione is a powerful and primary antioxidant that is produced inside the cell. And glutathione actually bathes the cell and the inside, protecting it against damaging free radicals and thus reducing inflammatory response. And secondly, sulforaphane has been found to cause cell death in the cancer cells by inducing specific enzymes and proteins that cause cancer cells to die. It also decreases the expression of estrogen receptors, which is so important for several types of breast cancer. So it's just good on all things. It also can help men with prostate cancer, bladder cancer, liver cancer, ovarian, and colon and lung cancers, men and women. So if you want to protect your genes and you want to engage in the new science of epigenetics that helps us see that we can control our destiny by helping bring things in like sulforaphane from broccoli sprouts that actually signal the DNA and the genes to express themselves in a healthy way. So that's the good nutrient of the day. Inexpensive, relatively speaking, yes. Can you sprout them yourself? You bet. It's easy to sprout everything. But you got to want to do it, and you got to do it on a regular basis. So I'm a big believer in sprouts. I believe we should be having at least 5 or 10 different types of sprouts each day in a salad. And but let's say that you say, okay, what else can I do to help me, you know, kill those tumor cells? Well, curcumin, resveratrol, quercetin, genistein, piperine from black pepper, parathionylidoid from butterbur, and andrographolide. Those also are always in a holistic cancer protocol. So those are all good things that we should be doing on a regular basis. I'm Gary Noll. That's our Health Nutrition Report. Now, I'm going to share a few clips today that I think are important. One of them is about having the courage to stand up and challenge your colleagues in Congress, in this case, Bernie Sanders, the independent candidate or politician from Vermont, and speak out to them, especially when you've seen that though there was a all but one vote agreeing in committee that all food in America should be genetically engineered, should be labeled, it was killed by those Democrats and Republicans in the Senate who voted against it because they all got money from the organization. But there's also this. What don't we know about Monsanto leading this whole fight that we should from an outside independent British news service? We're going to play a couple clips back to back to give you some insights. Now, Bernie Sanders, yesterday speaking in the U.S. Senate.
Mr. President, I agree that deficit reduction is a real issue, and I think we have got to deal with it. But we are not, if I have anything to say about it, going to deal with it on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, and the hungry. The way you deal with deficit reduction in a responsible way, in a fair way, is you say to the billionaires in this country who are doing phenomenally well, you make the point that Warren Buffett made, that there's something a little bit absurd that millionaires and billionaires today, in the midst of the deficit crisis, are paying the lowest tax rates that they have paid in decades. So yes, we're going to have to ask the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. I saw a piece in the paper the other day. It was quite incredible. The rich people apparently leave in America. They're giving up their citizenship. They're going abroad. These great lovers of America who made their money in this country, when you ask them to start paying their fair share of taxes, they're running abroad. We have 19-year-old kids in this country who died in Iraq and Afghanistan defending this country. They went abroad. Not to escape taxes. They're working class kids who died in wars, and now the billionaires want to run abroad in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. What patriotism. What love of country. So, Mr. President, yeah, we got to deal with deficit reduction. But you don't cut Social Security. You don't cut Medicare. You don't cut Medicaid. You don't cut education. You ask the wealthiest people, the millionaires and billionaires, to start paying their fair share of taxes. You end these outrageous corporate loopholes. Senator Conrad showed a picture of a building in the Cayman Islands where there are 18,000 corporations. They're there in the Cayman Islands using a postal address in order to avoid paying their taxes. We're losing about $100 billion a year. You have large corporations making billions, paying in some cases nothing in taxes. That's the way you go to deficit reduction, not on the backs of people who are already hurting. So, Mr. President, we are in a very difficult moment in American history. We're in the process of losing the great middle class. We're seeing more of our people being poor. We're seeing savage attacks being waged against the elderly in terms of cuts in Social Security and Medicare, attacks against those who get sick in terms of going after Medicaid and Medicare. And I think what the American people are saying is enough is enough. This country, this great country, belongs to all of us. It cannot continue to be controlled by a handful of billionaires who apparently want it all. You know, I cannot understand why people who have billions of dollars are compulsively driven for more and more and more. When is enough enough? How many children in this country have got to go hungry? How many people have got to die because they don't go to a doctor? Because you want to avoid paying your taxes. Well, that's not what America is about. That's not what people fought and died to create. So, Mr. President, with that, we've got a fight on our hands. The job of the United States Senate is to represent the middle class, working families of this country, all of the people, and not just the super rich. And I hope we can begin to do that. Thank you very much. With that, I yield the floor.
Now we're going to hear about Monsanto, a major player in the politics, always has access to the FDA and the USDA and the White House. And they put a lot of money into a lot of people's campaigns. They bought the votes.
Together, we can face the challenges of the next generation and beyond.
Improving agriculture, improving lives. The motto of the world's largest producer of pesticides and genetically modified seeds.
We're Monsanto, and we're working with farmers and partners worldwide to realize a vision for sustainable agriculture.
A vision not sustained by all. Thousands of Vietnamese still suffer from the effects of Agent Orange, the deadly Monsanto chemical sprayed by the U.S. during the Vietnam War. And the town of Anniston, Alabama, is still poisoned with toxic chemicals, contamination covered up by Monsanto for over 40 years.
Court documents showed their response when the executives learned that they were quietly poisoning the people of Anniston, Alabama with their PCB factories. They said, "We can't afford to lose $1 of business."
Today, they're most recognized for their growing monopoly over genetically modified seeds they patent, seeds that many argue do more harm than good.
Genetically engineered crops are devastating biodiversity, insects, human health, and our chances of producing food into the future.
Currently, 70% of food in the U.S. contains genetically modified ingredients, but consumers have no way of telling as there's no labeling requirement. And when polled, 95% of Americans support mandatory labeling. So states are taking their own initiative, like Vermont.
Despite passing out of the House Agricultural Committee by a vote of 9-1, the bill didn't make it any further because of the fear of a lawsuit from this huge multinational corporation.
A reasonable fear. 144 small farmers who say Monsanto's GM seeds blew into their farms and cross-pollinated have already been sued for patent infringement.
There's a disease that's been affecting many of the commercial pollinators, affect the population of the bees. And in fact, about a third of the bees die every year due to colony collapse.
The latest buzz about Monsanto is that their genetically engineered crops and herbicides could be a factor in the decimation of the honeybee colonies. In Poland, 1,500 beekeepers recently demonstrated against Monsanto's Mon 810 corn, depositing thousands of dead bees at the Ministry of Agriculture.
In Europe, they are against GMOs because they know about it.
In the U.S., Smith says,
it's been a carefully controlled media control coup.
In another coup, according to critics, Monsanto bought bee research firm Biologics last year.
Biologics has also passed themselves off as the ones investigating colony collapse disorder, explaining why it happens, and certainly we won't see Biologics investigating the connection between GMOs and colony collapse disorder.
Monsanto claims it's the responsibility of the FDA to assess GMO risks, but the revolving door between the corporation and government could be distorting the facts.
The person in charge of policy at the FDA, who made that policy, and hands-off policy, was Monsanto's former attorney, later Monsanto's vice president, and now back at the FDA as U.S. food safety czar.
Hardly reassuring for Americans concerned about the safety of their food. Abby Martin, RT, Washington.
Now, my question is simple. Why is it that we have to get this information from a European quality news source, and it's not on any of the mainstream? Nor are there any major investigative reports challenging Monsanto, the showing who from its organization, over 40 people, went on to work in powerful policy positions in the different administrations, and what that meant then as far as our policies, not helping the American people. We share it with you, but no one else does. And finally, before we go to your calls, actually before we go to our environmental segment, today we were told that, with a great deal of fanfare, that the United States and Israel are conducting the largest, most complex war game maneuvers in Israel and the United States history together in what many assume and what the media is hinting will be a prelude to either an invasion or attack upon Iran. Here's the story they didn't tell you. And you ask yourself, which one defines our government and our media and the Israeli government and the Israeli media as far as getting their priorities straight?
Now, up to 700 Palestinian children are arrested every year, and many are physically abused and denied access to their parents or a lawyer. That's according to a team of British lawyers who visited Israel. They accuse Israel's security forces of regularly breaching the UN Convention on Children's Rights. And as our foreign affairs correspondent Jonathan Rugman reports, their findings have now been published.
Today's report says that hundreds of Palestinian children are arrested every year and often at night. In this incident from 2010, four teenagers were arrested for throwing stones, the youngest just 13. Though Israel says violence and threats towards children are forbidden, many child suspects say they've been blindfolded, physically and verbally abused, and forced to sign statements in Hebrew, which they can't understand. Stone throwing is a daily hazard of Israel's occupation, with under-18s subjected to Israeli military law. The report found that teenagers are often not granted access to a lawyer till after questioning. Children can be detained without charge for up to 188 days, and prison sentences for throwing stones can range from 2 weeks to 10 months. Wissam Tamimi is 16 and was arrested for stone throwing. He says he was forced to confess in exchange for a shorter sentence of 5 months in jail.
While I was in the jeep, they would beat me. I was held from 6 in the morning till 1 at night. At the end, they took me to prison. When they took me from the car, they tied my hands and covered my eyes, and they took me into a checkpoint. They grabbed my hands and tied them behind me, like this, and covered my eyes. The cuffs were very tight.
This is rare footage of a 14-year-old interrogated by Israeli officers last year. The questioning lasts over 5 hours, and the child is clearly exhausted. At one point, he starts sobbing. Neither his parents nor a lawyer are in the room. He was eventually detained for 2 months for throwing stones and then released to house arrest. Today's report concludes that Israel's treatment of child prisoners breaches the Geneva Conventions and the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child. The boy is from the village of Nabi Saleh in the West Bank. Protests involving stones frequently break out here in response to an illegal Israeli settlement taking what was Palestinian water. Teenagers in the village include Anan Tamimi, who's now been arrested 3 times, even though he's only 16.
On the question of arresting kids, the jails are never empty. All the time people go in and come out. With my friends at school, when someone gets out, someone else goes in.
The human rights organization B'Tselem filmed this footage of the Israeli army on its night rounds in Nabi Saleh. First, they wake the children, then they photograph them for their records. Israel says detained children are told of their right to silence and to a lawyer. But today's report says the fear that every Palestinian child could become a terrorist has led to a spiral of injustice, which, it says, only Israel can reverse.
Well, in a statement to Channel 4 News, the Israeli government said
that we never hear of this. Even to have discussions on all sides, we don't hear about it. That's how much control that the media has placed into the hands of special lobbying groups. A few more commentaries, and then I'll open up our phones today. I've been sharing information daily about the dangers of genetically engineered foods. This is the latest from Denise Gertzberg from GMO Journal. Quote, to borrow a phrase from Bill Maher, here's a new rule. Any time a GMO advocate gushes about the benefits and safety of genetically engineered products, someone must recite the following statistics from Food and Water Watch. Since 1999, the 50 largest agricultural and food patent-holding companies and two of the largest biotech companies and agrochemical trade associations have spent more than $572 million in campaign contributions lobbying expenditures, $500 million. Lobbying expenditure for food and agriculture biotechnology more than doubled in just from up until 2009. Food and Agriculture Biotechnology PACs gave $22 million in campaign contributions. Also, food and agriculture biotechnology firms employ more than 300 former congressional and White House staff members as lobbyists. In addition to in-house lobbyists, the food and agriculture biotechnology firms employed 100 lobbying firms last year alone. That's separate firms. Would you like to know about Monsanto's lobbying efforts? Thanks to data gathered by the Center for Responsive Politics, one could argue that Monsanto is dedicated to genetically engineering Washington, D.C. to express laws and regulations that favor its interest. In the first 3 months of this year, Monsanto spent $1.4 billion lobbying Washington. Monsanto spent $6.3 million total in lobbying last year, more than any other agribusiness company except the tobacco company, Altria. Monsanto aggressively uses lobbyists to promote its corporate interest. The company lobbied bills ranging from the American Research and Competitiveness Act of 2011, which would extend tax credits for companies doing research, to several bills that would change the way the Department of Homeland Security handles security at chemical facilities. And it goes on. So Monsanto literally controls our government on so many levels when it comes to food. This is from Science Daily, and this is reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So you think maybe every doctor and scientist in the United States would say, I will not allow any of my patients to use genetically engineered material? No. Here's what I'm quoting from them. Quote, pests are adapting to genetically modified crops in unexpected ways. Researchers have discovered all this. The findings underscore the importance of closely monitoring and countering pest resistance to biotech crops. Resistance of cotton bollworm to insect-killing cotton plants involves more diverse genetic changes than expected, an international research team reports in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So what this is saying is that every time they create a new genetically modified crop spray, the animals, the creatures, the insects adapt to it, and it just makes the environment more polluted, can harm more people, and they have no long-term studies showing what else it does. Big problem. This is also from Science Daily, as reported by researchers at Oregon State University. Here's what it says, and it's published in Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. Carcinogens linked to cancer stems, That's a different study. This is from EchoWatch. Genetic engineers explain why genetically engineered food is dangerous. Quote, these are all top scientists in genetic engineering. Research studies show that genetically modified crops have harmful effects on laboratory animals and feeding trials and on the environment during cultivation. They have increased the use of pesticides and have failed to increase yield. Our report concludes that there are safer and more effective alternatives, how about organic, to meeting the world's food needs. Another author of the report, Dr. John Fagan, is a former genetic engineer, and he also said crop genetic engineering as practiced today is a crude, imprecise, and outmoded technology. Now, here are some key points that are from this report. Genetic engineering, as used in crop development, is not precise, nor is it predictable, and has not been shown to be safe. The technique can result in unexpected production of toxins or allergens in food that are unlikely to be spotted in current regulatory checks. Genetically modified crops, including some that are already in our food and animal feed supply, have shown clear signs of toxicity in animal feeding trials, notably disturbances in liver and kidney function and immune response. genetically modified proponents, or the advocates, have dismissed these statistically significant findings as, quote, not biologically relevant or significant, but scientifically indefensible arguments are not a substitute for what we have, which is good science. So on the one hand, good science shows genetically engineered foods are not safe, and paid for science shows it, don't worry, be happy. Also, genetically modified foods have never been properly tested in humans, but the few studies that have been carried out in humans give cause for concern. And the FDA does not require mandatory safety testing of GM crops and does not even assess the safety of GM crops, but only deregulates them based upon assurances from these companies that they are equivalent to any other food that's grown. They are not. So that's just some more reasons why we should be very concerned about genetically engineering anything. And finally, for a few other commentaries, short ones but important. This is about the gulf between two Presidential Peace Prize winners. I'll quote this. The lead interrogator at the Division Interrogation Facility had given me specific instructions. I was to deprive the detainee of sleep during my 12-hour shift by opening his cell every hour, forcing him to stand in a corner and be stripped of his clothes. 3 years later, the tables have turned. It is rare that I sleep through the night without a visit from this man. His memory harasses me as I once harassed him. This was written by Eric Fair in the Washington Post in 2007 regarding his experience as a contract interrogator in Iraq in 2004. As terrible as his experience was, we now know that even greater abuses against prisoners took place not only in Iraq, but in Guantanamo and all other places holding prisoners from the so-called War on Terror. Those abuses show human beings at their worst. Predictably, Mr. Fair's admission drew an equally abusive response. Writing in Harper's Magazine, Fair mentions the following, quote, Eric, I still have a .45 caliber gun. I suspect you know the firearm. I'd loan it to you gleefully if you'd get really depressed, and I'd be happy to take whatever legal consequences might come on my way for having done so. You'd be doing the world a favor by removing yourself from the gene pool. With revulsion at the subhuman you and others like you surely are, end quote. Fair's testimony makes for painful reading, but it is fundamental to better understand what has been going on in Iraq, Guantanamo, Afghanistan, and other places of detention, and probably will continue to occur. But it also reveals the consequences for those who carried out the abuses, who don't remain immune to horror after the experience, a horror they try to overcome with a life of service to their fellow humans. Fair is now a pastor in a Presbyterian church. Fair's admissions are particularly relevant after giving former President Jimmy Carter a recent opinion piece in the New York Times entitled A Cruel and Unusual Record. A former Nobel Prize winner, Carter makes a strong criticism of the United States human rights policies, particularly President Obama's approval of legislation that makes legal the president's right to detain a person indefinitely on suspicion of affiliation with any organization or associated forces. According to Carter, quote, this law violates the right to freedom of expression and to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, two other rights enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. Also, there is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written under U.S. leadership. Carter's criticism follows a similar assessment from several human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights. Quote, despite expressing serious reservations, the Obama administration has paved the way for legislation that will authorize indefinite detention. The bill places enormous power in the hands of future presidents, and the only answer the president has to say is, trust me. Well, human rights groups argue that indefinite detention constitutes torture, particularly because it creates conditions of secrecy and isolation that facilitate abuses and contravene the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Prohibition against cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Former President Carter's comments place him at odds with President Barack Obama and his human rights policies. It is a sad paradox that President Obama was given the Nobel Peace Prize precisely because the Nobel Committee believed that with his actions he would strengthen peace, human rights, and the reign of law. However, Mr. Carter's comments are a firm rebuttal of present U.S. policies. Quote, at a time when popular revolutions are sweeping the globe, the United States should be strengthening, not weakening, basic rules of law and principles of justice enumerated in the U.S. In the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that's from an M.D., Ph.D., and co-winner of the Overseas Press Award of America and foreign correspondent for Middle East Times, Dr. Sasir Chalela. And one other I found of interest. As you know, we learned nothing leading up to the NATO's invasion in Libya. And everything we predicted would happen after the invasion has actually happened. The country is in multiple civil wars. There is conflict everywhere. Everyone wants the oil. Everyone wants the water. An enormous amount of death and destruction between the different 2,000 different groups are occurring now. As if to learn nothing from Libya, we're now engaging in a similar situation in Syria. Whatever the ultimate outcome in Syria, we should pay attention to what we haven't been told to give some perspective on what we do. This is from Joyce Chediak of Global Research, a very high-quality group of researchers who says, quote, Washington has funneled money to a right-wing Syrian opposition group since 2005. The U.S. reopened its embassy in Damascus in January 2011 after 6 years. This was no thaw in relations. The new ambassador, Robert Ford, who served until October 2011, is a protege of John Negroponte, who organized death squads in El Salvador in the 1970s and in Iraq while ambassador there in 2004 and 5. There are terrorist kill squads killed tens of thousands. Ford served directly under Negroponte as the U.S. At the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Ford played a central role in laying the groundwork within Syria as well as establishing contacts with opposition groups. 2 months after he arrived in Damascus, the armed insurgency began. Armed opposition at al-Saud began in March 2011 in Deraa, a small town at the Jordanian border. Mass protest movement usually started in large population centers. Later, Saudi Arabia admitted sending weapons to the opposition via Jordan. The U.S. and its NATO allies used grassroots protests in Egypt, Syria, and elsewhere as a cover to build support for right-wing insurgencies whose goal was not to help the Syrian people, but to bring Syria into the pro-imperialist camp. Any excesses or mistakes by the Assad government were not the real issue. The Arab League, European Union, and the U.S. began imposing economic sanctions, a form of warfare, against Syria in November 2011 on the pretext of stopping state-sanctioned violence against protesters. Stepped-up sanctions and freezing of Syrian assets caused the value of the Syrian pound to drop by 50% against the dollar, with the cost of necessities tripling. Exiles who received U.S. funding became part of the Syrian National Council and wound up going back to open up Syria to the West and end Syria's strategic relationship with Iran and with the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance. And then with NATO, ex-CIA agent Philip Giraldi admitted that the U.S. was involved in Syria and laid out the U.S. plan. Quote, NATO was already clandestinely engaged in the Syrian conflict, with Turkey taking the lead as the U.S. proxy. Ankara's foreign minister has openly admitted that his country is preparing to invade as soon as there is agreement among the Western allies to do so. The intervention would be based on humanitarian principles to defend the civilian population based on the responsibility to protect doctrine that was invoked to justify Libya. Giraldi continued, quote, unmarked NATO warplanes are arriving at Turkish military bases close to the Syrian border, delivering weapons from the late Muammar Gaddafi's arsenals, as well as volunteers from the Libyan Transitional National Council who are experienced in pitting local volunteers against trained soldiers. French and British special forces are on the ground assisting the Syrian rebels, while the CIA and the U.S. Special ops are providing communications equipment and intelligence. The frequently cited United Nations report that more than 3,500 civilians have been killed by Assad soldiers is based largely on rebel sources and is uncorroborated. Likewise, accounts of mass defections from the Syrian army and pitched battles between deserters and the loyal soldiers appear to be a fabrication, with few defections being confirmed independently. Syrian government claims that it is being assaulted by rebels who are armed, trained, and financed by foreign governments are actually true. The Free Syrian Army has rear bases in Turkey, is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and is made up of defecting Syrian soldiers. Spiegel Online, that's Der Spiegel, the German publication, cites a source in Beirut, reports, quote, seeing hundreds of foreign fighters who have attached themselves to the opposition. And then it goes on. Dozens of pages of who actually engaged in the massacres and why it's all happening. Well, it's happening because take out Syria, overthrow the government, put in a puppet regime, possibly one that's friendly to us, such as they would probably have a Turkish interim government. And then suddenly you cut off Iran and you cut off China and Russia from being able to exploit its resources. But the American public is not getting a single solitary piece of this information, only what we're told by our official media. I'm Gary Nall. Those are some issues that are not making the rounds, not out there before our consciousness, and I believe they should be, and that's why I shared them with you. And now we're going to take a brief break, come back, and take your calls at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. No guest today, so we can take some calls, more calls from you right now at 888-874-4888. But we always offer one day a week. We take about 3 minutes and offer you a special that provides the income that helps support the Progressive Radio Network. Try to give you something that you can really use and give it at a great value. And today, I don't remember giving this as a special in the last 3 years. Because we've been out of stock on this for almost 6 months. The reason we're out of stock is because the factory that actually produces our goods was out for months, over 9 months, and only got up slowly, and that's why we ran out of some stuff. But fortunately, now that's back in. Today's special, the Super AM and Super PM formula. Now, the Super AM, Super PM formula is a one-a-day, but it's a very comprehensive one-a-day. I looked at all the things I believe that we should have in the way of supplements each day and in the amounts that would make a difference, and we took them. So this way, if you're on a particular protocol and you're taking lots of vitamin C, that's fine. But with this one, you're taking the vitamins, you take the AM in the morning because I believe that the body best absorbs certain nutrients in an anabolic state and then others in the evening in a catabolic state. So I divide them AM and PM. Hence, you get two different bottles. You get an AM bottle and you get a PM bottle. Now, for example, in the AM bottle, you're getting a vitamin C and E, B1, B2, pantothenic acid, folic acid, biotin, pyrimine and benzoic acid, niacinamide, vitamin K, iron, zinc, boron, iodine, copper, potassium, coenzyme Q10, quercetin, pycnogenol, ginkgo, green tea, glutathione, linolenic acid, phosphatidylserine, lutein, citrus bioflavonoids, N-acetylcysteine, and betaine hydrochloride. Now, in the PM, you're getting vitamin A, vitamin C, D, B6, B12, calcium, magnesium from citrate, the best forms, manganese, chromium, molybdenum, selenium, choline, inositol, rutin, hesperidin, glutamic acid, lipase, bromelain, papain, cellulase, protease, and melatonin, and acetyl-L-carnitine. So these are in vegetarian capsules. So these are two very important vitamins to take, AM in the morning, PM in the evening. They're labeled AM and PM. The most unique way to take vitamins. And they're given to people who want a full spectrum of all the nutrients without the hassle. I'm going to give you a number now to call in. And you're going to get a great deal on this. The special price is $35.99. That's a good deal. All right? So both your AM and PM, $35.99. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Today, instead of reading you an email, I know that there's a lot of people that are going to relate to this. This is a new story that came out today. Stockton, California is declaring bankruptcy. This is going to make history, and the article here says residents are reeling. Now, I know that Stockton got hit hard. During the economic boom, they were these people that were entrenched in poverty try to reinvent themselves, and they built all kinds of housing tracts, and everyone that came in bought on credit. So when the bust came, the city right now has the second highest rate of foreclosures in the country, and of course the second highest rate of violent crime in the state. Now, the city made $90 million in drastic cuts from general funds, like the police department, 25%, the fire department, 30%, and cutting pay and benefits to all its employees. Correct me if I'm wrong. You spoke about this about 2 years ago on your show. You spoke of how the people were going to be hit the hardest, and that's what's happening. And there may be chaos in the streets without these essential services. So what are your thoughts on this?
I don't believe that you'll see chaos in the streets, but you will see essential services cut. You'll start to see those municipalities, not just Compton, which at one time was supposed to be the commute community for San Francisco. If you couldn't afford to live in San Francisco downtown or immediately around it, Marin County or Berkeley, you moved down to Compton. But all that faded when they overbuilt, overpromised, and overnegotiated all their employee and other contracts, thinking that the boom would never stop. It did. They spent over $90 million just this year alone, cut from the budget. That means then that a lot of people will lose most of their pensions. That means that it will be rife for criminal activity, because if you cut your police and you cut your fire department and you cut other basic services, you cut your mail deliveries, you cut how often you pick up the sewage, the garbage, all of these, how often you repair streets that are bad, what happens if there's a storm, then you end up creating an environment that we see in Greece. And in Greece, you're seeing people living in abject poverty, going through garbage piles. So it'll come over about a year period. You'll start to see a once beautiful environment decay. Now, there were always little tiny bad spots in Compton, but now the whole area is going to be metastasized. It'll all be one crime area. There won't be any safe place to live. And then it starts to spread out from there. And then the value of other real estate closest to it will start to be eroded, and everybody will keep moving away, trying to get out of that harm's way. You would have to go into some gated communities before you're out of harm's way. In gated communities, you pay to live in there. They have security. You can't get in unless you're belonging there or visiting someone in there. And there you'll have a quality of life and some basic service. In fact, for all intents and purposes, you would know there's a problem. Like the wealthy people looking down from a high, a balcony overlooking, Fifth Avenue and Central Park, you'd never know what's going on, because you're not down on the street and you're not looking into Harlem, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island. You're not looking over New Jersey, Jersey City, and other places that are getting hit. So, yes, I see Compton declaring bankruptcy, but, Luann, I predict that at least 500 cities minimally will declare bankruptcy in the next 3 years. A state can't declare bankruptcy, but cities will. And how often have you heard, you know, a state's great because of all of its great cities, and then you start realizing a lot of those cities are no longer good to live in, and certainly not in downtown areas. And so why be in Grosse Pointe, just 35 minutes north of downtown Detroit, if you got to go through one of the worst crime-ridden sections and poverty sections of America to get into a place that's okay? You won't want to do that. So that's what I see coming at us in the United States.
Well, it's starting.
It's starting, and there's no. I wish I could say there's a happy outcome. There is no happy outcome for that. For those people who are able to get out of harm's way, to move into environments that are going to be sustainable in the future, yes, there will be millions of Americans moving out of the city and out of the suburbs. I see people selling their homes and buying RV vehicles, which would be a good first step. And I think that would be one of the smartest things people could do. Move to the locations, at least have the flexibility, because RVs are one-third to one-tenth the price of a house. You don't have all the taxes. You don't have to have all the leasehold improvements and the upkeep. And you're fluid, you're flexible, you can go anywhere. That, I see, as being a smart move.
That's great. That's great information. I'm not sure the people, though, in Greece are going to be so civil, because these are very emotionally charged people, and Greece is going through their austerity, and it's pushing these people closer and closer to the edge, Gary.
I see there's two things we have to understand about Greece. First, the American media always gets it wrong. Always. They're incapable of understanding anything happening. They're going to look at, first, the Greece is in concern. Are they going to pay back the debt? To whom? To the people who created the debt, the banks. All right, because public sector spending was minimal compared to the debt that was the financial debt, building up artificial bubbles. So everybody profited and exploited the bubbles and the corruption that is endemic in the Greece culture. With few people who are wealthy paying taxes and a lot of people living on the dole if they can. White hat, black hat here. Everything in Greece is gray. But this is their wake-up call. Fine, it's like the person that smokes and then gets cancer and then wants to sue the, you know, tobacco company. Okay, well, why don't you sue yourself for being stupid in the process? All right, I believe everyone who does that is just looking for someone to blame. But at the same time, you legitimately have people to blame. In the case of Greece, here's what I see. First, I see those people who had the power and the money to influence elections, in effect buying the elections. But almost all of them were people who supported the bailout. These people would not have done this if there wasn't something in it for them, and almost always something like a job or a business to their companies. Some way that they get a benefit above what the average person would for not voting in a conscious way to revive the economy. Now, the public will let that happen because it was part of their democratic process. But now, when seniors and unionists and are having to take 20 to 25% cuts in their cost of living allowances, when the price of food and everything goes up, when they have to pay for other services they historically didn't, then they will go to the streets. And I predict that before October, the people in Greece will throw out their existing majority and state, we will not pay any more to any get banks, and go off the euro. That will cause some crisis, but they could also take the model of Iceland that is today thriving, where it would have been completely in debt forever had it not said no to paying back the banks. Okay? That's
good.
Good. Well, thank you, Luann. We're out of time. I want to thank everyone for taking their time to share their thoughts and listen in. I appreciate it. I'm Gary Nall. And by the way, this just came across my desk. Recent events throughout Greece suggest the public mood has worsened following the pro-bailout, pro-austerity victory. Greek police walk by a burning building in Athens during protest. And then it goes on, the austerity program has taken a catastrophic toll on the nation. 820,000 Greeks are officially out of work, as the unemployment rate is officially at 22%, more than double it was 10 years ago. Greece's suicide rate has doubled. Quote, from the end of the Weimar Republic in Germany to the 1930s, the anti-government demonstrations in Greece in 2010-11, austerity has tended to go hand-in-hand with politically motivated violence and social instability. These findings cast doubts on the established wisdom until the sovereign debt crisis 2010 that we should be following the official version, which means give back the money. This isn't going to last. I promise you, Greece will burn. Crisis and riots will occur in the next 6 months. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for the Mike Fader Show coming up now, and Mike Fader's in studio. Ask me to stick by for a few moments, say hello to him. Back in a moment with the Mike Fader Show on the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to thank the 2,160,000 people who went to Gary Knoll TV after we put up there our watch the documentary, The War on Health, free for you to download.